Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
Hello and welcome to a very special Labor Day edition of Brain Trust Live.
This week on the podcast, the Obama administration decisively passes the buck on Syria.
And we've got a brief people's history of Labor Day.
Plus, Bob McDonald doesn't know what he knows.
And America's Secretary of Explaining Stuff is back.
This week in We Told You So, we talk immigration reform.
And Brain Trust puts Congress on notice, because now even Chris Christie has passed an equal pay law.
Plus, 41 learns the hard way that just because the obituary is written doesn't mean the person is dead.
All this and more. Plus, don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram. This is Brain Trust Live. Happy Labor Day, everybody.
Yeah. That was a little Solidarity Forever, sung by Pete Seeger.
And me.
Yeah. It's got real to-the-point lyrics. That's why we chose it.
It does.
There was no mistaking whether that was a labor song.
We didn't have to wait for the chorus.
No.
It really just...
That was the chorus. That was everything that we needed to tell you.
Right there.
Right there. Solidarity forever. The union makes us strong. Me and Brent don't belong to a union, so that's a sad thing. But we were both from labor households of sorts.
Yes, true.
So, so we would welcome a union if we could belong to one.
Yeah.
My life's goal really has been to belong to a union, but there's so few of them to belong to now.
Yeah.
That there's not really a lot of options, and I'm sort of mad at the teachers union in New York because they're selling out their younger members a lot of the time.
Right.
And I'm mad at a lot of unions for
doing
that.
We talked to
your
mom
city.
Yeah, about that.
We did.
On Labor Day last year.
We did.
Yes.
And so we have been left in a sad unionless generation, basically.
Very sad.
But we're going to talk a little bit later on about why this Labor Day is sort of fake anyway. So before we get into that, the big news of the week is that the Syria situation is not getting better.
No. We talked about it last week.
Trying to figure out what to do.
We felt like we had to. And this week, we really have to.
Right. It's like all there is to talk. Well, and this week, it took on a more domestic quality. Because this week, the discussion was not really about what's going on in Syria, which we already know. It was about what the U.S. is going to do about it. Because we always feel like we have to do something about everything.
Right. It turns out we don't really know.
We don't know.
We knew. Initially.
Right.
At the beginning of the week,
everybody
knew. Everybody was on the
same
page.
Up until about Friday, everyone knew.
Right. We had a red line. It had been crossed.
Right.
Obama wanted to go to war. John Kerry had been...
Made the case.
He was
all over making speeches this week about the case.
Mm-hmm. Talking about human dignity and all sorts of...
Like he had maybe discussed this with Obama at some point.
Right.
Turns out, no.
Nope.
That's not what happened.
No one was on the same page here.
Least of all, Obama was not even on the same page as himself, because he had initially sort of said that if chemical weapons were used, we would 100% be intervening, because that violates a bunch of international sort of like treaties
norms.
And codes and norms. But then on Saturday, made a speech where he basically was like, well, we're just going to let Congress decide.
Right. We should go in.
Right.
But if they don't decide right,
do anything about it.
He sort of left it open to the fact that he potentially doesn't care whether Congress
gives
him the authorization or not.
I think that probably, this could have had something to do with the fact that British Parliament was like, hell no.
No. The first time in two centuries that they have not authorized a war, the British
really?
Parliament.
It was that long ago, the last time. Good for them. Mm-hmm. Taking a stand. Well, here's why. And I can't believe that they were even considering it, because, I mean, that was like the biggest blemish on Tony Blair's career, was going in with us to Iraq.
Yeah.
It was hugely unpopular there. No one else in Europe went along with it except Poland. And David Cameron should have been like, you know what? I don't want to go the way of Tony Blair. He sort of didn't end the Clintonian figure that he began as.
Well,
and it was partially because he kept authorizing these wars that no one wanted to be involved in.
Yeah, I think that no vote is a direct reaction to the debacle of Iraq.
I think absolutely.
100%.
Well, and I think that is partially what Obama is getting at here as well, where he sort of was talking about going to war, and then probably one of his advisors was like, you sound a lot like Bush. And he probably had to be like, yes.
Right.
Right.
But he's gone to war without congressional approval before. He did it in Libya.
I mean
there's... He doesn't...
he's certainly not...
He doesn't really have a policy.
Following a policy of any sort.
No. There's no... It doesn't seem to be an Obama doctrine that I can specifically point to. Right,
I think now. That this feels like a bigger situation than Libya. Because the allies are a lot bigger. You know, as I was saying to Brent as we were watching the news this morning, I was like, this is going to start a world war. Like, China's angry that we're thinking about going in. Russia's angry. Like, all of the other big nations, the big sort of policeman states, are angry about us trying to go in.
Right.
We're going to have, like, a world war between Russia, China, and Iran and us.
Right. Over a Syrian...
Over a
sectarian...
civil... A sectarian violence in Syria.
Right. Which has been going on...
For
years.
Yeah.
The other thing that I just don't get about this is that, I mean... I understand why everyone treats sort of like chemical weapons as a separate threat.
Yes.
And, you know, it's obviously tragic that they were used this week and, you know, 1,000 people, I guess they're saying, died. It was sarin gas. It's a terrible thing to use.
Yeah.
This has been going on for 2 years and 100,000 people have died and over 1 million people have left the country into other countries.
Yeah.
So while I get that chemical weapons are bad.
Right.
I don't understand... how that all of a sudden trumps the other 99,000 people that have been killed in this
well,
in this
exactly.
War for the last
I mean,
2 years.
Once civilians are dying by the thousands in the first place,
The
tens of thousands in the first place, like, does it sort like, is there really a red line at chemical weapons? Couldn't we have been like, is there sort of like, couldn't we have had a policy that like civilian deaths? Where the issue, because that's the issue with chemical weapons.
Right.
Chemical weapons set a dangerous norm.
Correct.
But the issue with chemical weapons is that they're just in the air, so you can't really control who's affected.
Right, they're
by
not
them.
Necessarily, you're not targeting the other military with chemical
no,
weapons.
No, exactly.
You're just sort of like targeting a
and
spot
no,
that's going to have chemical weapons arbitrarily dumped
thrown into
and,
it. Right, and you're going to get a scene like what we saw coming out of Syria where just like regular everyday people were dropped on the spot because they were just like living in a spot.
Right.
But... I think that this is one of the reasons that it's difficult for the administration to make the case that this is somehow like a unique threat, because I don't think that to the American public this looks as like looks like a red line. You know, we have been talking about intervening and everyone was against it because we did that in Iraq and it was stupid.
Yep.
And this seems like such a similar situation, except that the civil war is happening before we get in instead of being caused by us.
Right.
But we know what happened once a civil war started in Iraq, and it's that we were just like this random third party. There was no good person to control the country.
Right.
Which is the case here. That we don't want to come in on the side of the militants because they're as crazy as Assad.
But the thing that is interesting about this is that everybody is, I mean, we're talking about it like we're going to somehow like sort of like intervene right now, but like even what Obama is talking about, and this may be why he's going to Congress, because I already heard somebody
some
like
time.
Pat Leahy saying that like the resolution is too broad, but like basically all they want to do is supposedly sort of like do some
airstrikes
to not even, they're not even necessarily trying to overthrow Assad. I mean,
thank God.
They may.
Right.
But, I mean, they're not, you know, they don't really have...
I think...
They're not trying to, like, intervene in the war. They're not trying to pick a side. They're basically just trying to punish Assad for using the chemical weapons, which
this
I sort of get, but on the other hand,
kind
it's just
of
sort like of,
like, how the
why
first
bother,
Iraq war started. Like, we were just going to do some airstrikes because we were flying, you know, over their airspace and doing airstrikes. And that's how all the ill will towards us in the region began, is with airstrikes. Airstrikes are also... as we know, not as targeted as we'd like them to be. And ultimately, the other thing that I think people sort of don't consider in these scenarios is that in this sort of situation where we're in a sectarian war, where everyone is sort of on a weird side against everyone else, everyone is sort of like both a military figure and a civilian. You know, the rebels are militants, but they're also civilians because they're just random ragtag groups of people like hanging out with big weapons that they're buying from like Russia or wherever and like using them arbitrarily. And that's why there's no standards in this war, because these aren't people that we don't have treaties with these people. Like these are just random people.
Right.
And
some of them are terrorist groups.
Many of them are terrorist groups or at least aligned with terrorist groups, because that is how... traditionally, in the Middle East, those terrorist groups have gotten legitimacy in the first place.
Hamas
is popular because Hamas was bringing services to Palestinians when no one else would.
Well, and that's how they get weapons, too. Like, when you're just a ragtag group of militants, I mean,
it's expensive to buy weapons.
You get backed by some larger ragtag group of militants that has some legitimacy.
But I think Obama's strategy is smart in that, you know, Congress doesn't come back till September 9th. The Senate is going to have hearings about this all week. It'll give everyone some time to sort of sit with what is going on. And if the American public at the end of the week is still like, nope, then Congress isn't going to authorize this. Because this is already, like, they already are going to have issues. I mean, I would say that Boehner's Congress would authorize this in a heartbeat because they love a good war. But they probably don't love an Obama war as much as they love a Bush war. So I think that they probably won't authorize it if it looks at all like it'll kill their approval ratings, which are already so low that...
Right.
Like, I don't think that... If it's not popular, they're not going to do it.
If any one of those Republicans dares ask how much this is going to cost, I'm going to literally fly myself to Washington and they should watch themselves.
Yeah. Some people are going to be thrown in some wells. But you know that's going to be their first question. Because it always is.
Right.
And Kerry was sort of trying to make the case all week, and he's still sort of, like, trying to sell the war idea.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I guess is his prerogative as Secretary of State. It makes him seem like
supposedly
a guy, but...
David Gregory asked him yesterday at Meet the Press if the... Because there were reports that the National Security Team was not happy when they learned about Obama's decision to ask Congress. And, of course, Kerry, you know, said no, that wasn't the case, and that he fully supported the president. But, I mean, like... It didn't seem like that earlier in the week.
Well, I think Kerry is the one driving... Like, I think that Obama said that red line thing and then was like, shit. And Kerry was like, now we have to go to war. And Obama was like, haha, but what if we ask Congress first?
And that's sort of what... God, I can't believe I'm quoting Rand Paul from yesterday's Meet the Press. But that's what he said, too. He was like, I don't think it's a great idea to be setting arbitrary red lines, which... I agree with.
Correct.
Like, you don't just be like, well, we're going to go to war if somebody does something. And then when they do that, then you're like, God damn.
There have been some scary sense makers. Because we're going to talk in a little bit about Sarah Palin's comments, which for someone who garbles English just sort of in her everyday life were oddly sensible.
Right. Offensive.
Offensive, for sure.
But sensible.
But sensible. But, yeah, I think, you know... The Senate is going to have hearings about this next week. They are already talking about drafting legislation that is less open-ended than what Obama is suggesting.
Right.
Because I think, rightfully so, they realize that the American people are not going to go into another open-ended war.
Correct.
But I think they're all buying time. And Kerry's probably just pissed that everyone's buying so much time. And I think it's the right thing to do, considering, like, if the British aren't going to come with us, like, who's going to come?
Sounds like the French might.
The French might.
The French may be
interested. French freedom fighters. Brent and I have been very pro-French of late. I was reading a book about the Revolutionary War.
I was watching John Adams.
And Brent was watching John Adams. And we got really incensed at the British, which I think we mentioned last week.
We did.
But we also became very pro-French because...
Well, they got
us out of a bind. They got us out of a bind. And then gave us a lovely statue that we still visit to this day. They were really nice to us.
We don't thank them enough for the statues.
No, it's... Mm-mm. I can understand where the sort of sentiment comes from because... When you actually are, like, face-to-face with a French person, they often seem very rude. But maybe they deserve to be that rude to us after buying us our freedom.
Perhaps.
You know? Laying down their lives for our freedom.
Yeah.
Even if it was just to spite the British, they deserve to be spited.
Yeah.
And now they're about to spite us because they're not going to come with us.
Yeah.
Which is the right choice for them, I think. I mean, if I were a British Parliament member, I would be like, oh, hell no. Like, I'm not getting involved in this business
again.
Right,
I know.
If I were an American congressperson, I would also be saying that, though.
I know.
So.
Even if it seemed more like a great idea than it actually does seem, you would still be a little scared of just, like, going on some sort of, like, you know, Middle East mission with America. Even if it was even if it was clear-cut, you'd be like, oh, God, this again?
Well, I don't understand why we feel like we need to be in charge of this effort. Like, if this was, like, a broad thing where everyone was talking about it, then, if we were having conversations with our sort of, like, other Security Council states as a group about what to do, that would be one thing. But the fact that this always, like, we're the cheerleaders of going to getting involved in these civil wars, like, always, just, like, blows my mind.
Right.
Because we're not anywhere near the Middle East. Like, France and Britain could be concerned, you know? First of all, that whole area is their former colonies. Second of all, like, these wars could spill over into Europe in certain ways because they're really fucking close. But, like...
Right. Well, and you've got Russia.
And you've got Russia, exactly.
I mean, you know, it's...
Like, these areas are all connected to the Mediterranean. So, like, this seems like it is a worthwhile concern for them. But, like, why are we always cheerleading the efforts of, you know, to do this sort of thing? It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Anyway, Moving on. Sarah Palin. Sense-making. So, we preface this by saying that it's a horribly offensive thing to say.
Yes.
Because, well, of course it was. She wasn't just going to let us get out scot-free. But she did say, and was it on Facebook that she posted this?
She takes to Facebook for a lot of her
crazy. As she said, as I said before, if we are dangerously uncertain of the outcome and are led into war by a commander-in-chief who can't recognize that this conflict is pitting Islamic extremists against an authoritarian regime with both sides shouting Allah Akbar at each other, then let Allah sort it out. The sentiment being, this is a fucking civil war.
Yeah.
Like, let it play out.
It's an Islamic civil war.
Yeah. And as much as I would have maybe done without the Allah Akbar comment at the end of that...
She could have left that part out.
She could have left that part out, and she could have been making sense for everyone.
There could have been a period after authoritarian regime.
Period. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But this is the thing, and I mean, not only is there sort of like no winning side to this, but it's also, you know, like you hear a lot of people saying like, well, we should try and, you know, instead of going in there, we should try and broker a peace deal. But there's no two sides to broker a peace deal. Like, that's the other problem here. Yeah. I mean, you've got, even if Assad decided tomorrow morning, for whatever reason, that he was ready to strike a deal with somebody and stop.
Yeah, like, who would we send into that meeting?
There's nobody who's the meeting with?
Well, and this is the issue that we have these very short-sighted visions of who we should support in these situations. This is, like, every, like, U.S.-installed dictator has at one point seemed like a good way of overthrowing another, like, U.S.-installed dictator.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically, I mean, this is what we do.
Yeah.
But, like, we go into these situations, very unthoroughly vet some person who it turns out is, like, a horrible authoritarian figure, just like the guy that we're trying to replace, who then eventually gets into cahoots with the wrong people, and then, you know, suddenly we're angry because he's been too, you know, because they have the death penalty or something.
Right.
Like, stuff that we do, too, that we just don't talk about.
Right.
And then we have to overthrow them. And it's just, like, a drain of resources. Because I don't need to be overthrowing dictators abroad, like, left, right, and center.
No.
They're capable of doing that themselves in the world.
They are.
I mean...
They do it all the time.
People are overthrowing and underthrowing dictators everywhere. Well, and that's, you know... And then we often intervene into populist sort of uprisings, like in Egypt... You know, they overthrew their own dictator, but then we were sort of like, well, we have to make sure they get another one so that we can talk to somebody.
I know, exactly.
But, I mean, this is the sort of situation where I can't even imagine, like, where they'll find the guy that they decide is the right guy.
Right.
But they'll find him, and they'll unthoroughly vet him. And then it will turn out that he's got ties to all sorts of terrorist organizations.
Right.
That he's secretly plotting the overthrow of Israel, which is our only goal in that region, is to make sure Israel is safe.
Becomes friendly with Iran.
Yeah.
I mean,
he's going to have to be, because he's right fucking next to it.
Right next to him. Exactly.
Like, I mean, for God's sakes.
Yeah. I mean, we can't
not being friendly with Iran is a different war that we're also going to have to intervene in.
Exactly.
So, it's like, what are we going to do?
There's no win there.
No, there's no win.
Gotta let Allah sort it out.
Exactly.
Wise words of Sarah Palin. Now, although, Rand Paul is just sort of concerned about this for a bizarre
set of reasons.
Which I don't really... I care about, but also don't care about.
Correct.
But anyway, he is sort of vaguely pro-Assad, because for many years, Assad has protected Christians in the region.
Right. There's like there are these Coptic Christians who are not like the kinds of Christians you and I have encountered in our lives. There's a huge Coptic community in Lebanon as well. And Lebanon was formed as a state to protect Christians because they were being sort of thrown out of Syria, basically.
Well, and Lebanon went through a similar situation, like, in the 70s.
Yeah,
into
they
the
had a major civil war.
Into even the 90s, basically, that sort of, a lot of people are sort of comparing this to, because
it
ultimately got itself quasi-sorted out after, you know, 20 years
of everybody killing each other. A civil war, and then somehow that ended up being a war with Israel that then sorted itself out after everyone got involved.
Right.
But the difference is that there is, like, that in Lebanon, something like 40% of the population is Christian.
Right.
And in Syria, that's a much smaller percentage.
Yeah.
Because Lebanon was the Christian part of Syria. It used to be Syria, and then it became its own state.
Right, in, like, the 20s or something, I think.
Exactly.
They drew all these lines when they were...
Right, because they were trying to get rid of the Christians, because they don't want to deal with them in Syria. So that is why Rand Paul, who has next to nothing in common with Coptic Christians, that's like having, you know, Taoists be... Like, it's just like a completely different religion, basically.
Right.
that's how he suddenly decided that Assad is cool.
Right. And I don't care about the Christians being protected. I think that anybody who is
should expect
just,
to be protected.
I was going to say, yeah, I don't necessarily think that we should install someone specifically to protect Christians, because if we do that, then we're going to continue on in the same fashion that we are right now. You have all the Islamic groups who are just still pissed at whoever's
there. That's just
there.
Like such an oddly specific thing to focus on in a state that has very few Christians.
Yeah.
Like, that's like a minority beyond what the sort of breakdown of the sort of Islamic order is. Because there's you know, this is a war between different sects of Islam, basically. And, like, the Christians are, like, not really factoring into it because there's not very many of them.
Right.
There's...
I think that... But, because he goes on to say, I think the Islamic rebels winning is a bad idea for Christians. And all of a sudden we'll have another Islamic state where Christians are persecuted. He could leave Christians out of this if he really wanted to. I mean, like, to a certain degree, I mean, this statement, I think the Islamic rebels winning is a bad idea for, you could insert any word
for
other than
people.
Christian, for humanity.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so.
Whatever.
I think his narrow arguments here are probably not helping him appeal to a broad group of people, but, I mean, that's not his
plan. People. No.
He's appealing to his people.
This, though, is a very odd concept, because it's sort of like, that's like being like, I think that so-and-so winning the mayoral race will be great for the Vietnamese in L.A. Like, it's sort of like a bizarrely specific sentiment to have in a place that has very few Christians. And also, when has this kind of Christian solidarity, like, ever been a thing? Like, Christians, A, all hate each other, too.
That's...
For one.
A lot of them, yes.
Yes. But, I mean, true. Also, this is never... I've never heard of this being a concern in the Middle East. Where, like, I've heard of it being a concern broadly in the Middle East, where a state like Lebanon is created, essentially to protect the Christians that are in Syria. But I've never heard of this being, like suddenly Christians are being persecuted, and that's why we need to
protect
dictators.
But they've been talking about it in Egypt a lot recently, too, though. I mean, this is sort of like
Egypt also has, like, Egypt is a lot bigger of a society than this.
Right.
Egypt didn't have a Christian state carved out of it to get the Christians out of it. There are Christians in Egypt. There's everyone in Egypt.
Right.
You know? But this is like, are we really going to have... Because this is buying into a type of politics that I don't think that we should buy into in the Middle East. These people are not all in control because they're from certain religious sects. That's a political organizing tool, and we know it. And they don't know it. That's fine. That's their prerogative. But we know it. And when we buy into this sort of religious-based political division, we're just sort of adding to the trouble there. We already have a fucking Christian state and a Jewish state that hate each other, and, you know, they're surrounded by Islamic states. Like, this is already a mess.
Yeah, this is not he's not helping here.
No, this is not helping anyone.
Trying to find
a safe place for Christians is like, why don't we find a safe place for children?
Or trying to find a dictator who was only concerned about the welfare of the Christians to take over in Syria.
It's fine if he's using sarin gas against his own people. As long as the Coptic Christians are safe, that's what we need to be most concerned about.
Yes. It's not, by the way.
No. Wrong.
Anyway, so that's Syria.
That's Syria.
Disaster.
Chaos. Anyway, happy Labor Day, though.
Back to that.
Celebratory day in the U.S. It's a holiday, for one. That's why we're coming to you slightly late.
I'm going to work later.
Brent's...
I worked yesterday. I'm doing a lot of ironic working this weekend.
Yeah, Brent is like a travesty this weekend.
Yeah.
That's why we're
recording today instead of yesterday.
Yeah, because of work.
Yeah.
Because of a Labor Day Sunday working situation.
That was real exciting.
God. It's like grim. No one cares about labor.
They don't.
Which is what they don't.
They don't. No one does.
Including the people that started Labor Day. First of all, though, good news. There are massive fast food worker strikes going on. The service sector is having some exciting...
Totally.
An exciting weekend. 58 cities on Thursday.
Yeah, which was more than they were sort of like initially expecting.
Yeah, they were anticipating 50. There have been these strikes going on in like Seattle and Milwaukee and some other places as well. But now, like, big places like L.A. had some strikes.
Yeah.
Boston, Denver, like
Houston.
Some big cities had strikes. And essentially, this is exciting not just because it's always exciting when people go on strike. It's exciting because these people aren't unionized. They're striking for the right to form unions.
Right. And to have a living wage.
Yeah.
A
I think that part of what bolstered this was when it came out that McDonald's was recommending that people go without heat and get second jobs in order to afford living on their wages. Yes, they
had the proposed budgets for their workers. Yeah. It also proposed them having a second job.
Yeah, a second job and to go without heat in the winter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, that's... Why have a job at that point?
Right, exactly.
Starve on the street.
Yeah.
You know? You're not... It's the same thing.
It is.
Like, This is exciting because this is almost like, this is like a rebirth of a labor movement. Because this is not a traditionally unionized sector of the economy.
Right.
It's the sector where most of these jobs that we're supposedly creating are coming from. You know, the service, like what no one tells you when we talk about job growth is that most of the jobs are crappy jobs.
Right.
And a lot of these people are being kept from working full time so that they're not having to
get benefits.
Get benefits. Yeah.
Like that. And we're already seeing reports of a lot of these places, you know, cutting people's hours down to 29
hours so that they don't have to give them healthcare under the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
But that's where all of our job growth is coming from. So this is an exciting development, and I think a necessary development, because if all of the job growth is coming from the service sector, then that's where everyone is working.
Yes.
And, you know, that once you have that much sort of like, once you have that much critical mass in the service sector, like, you need to do something about addressing the fact that they aren't living wage jobs.
Right.
But...
Well, and that's sort of what I think this discussion has led to. And I think you've even, you know, had a lot of lawmakers sort of, like, getting into this recently. And
talking about raising the minimum wage.
Raising the minimum wage. And, you know, everyone sort of, like, I think collectively agrees that if you work 40 hours a week, then you shouldn't have to have a second job if you're working hard, whether it's at a McDonald's or elsewhere. But, I mean, nobody can seem to get the will to sort of do anything about it. So I think that if this can lead to that, then that's...
There have been a lot of reports as well that, because the primary, you know, group of people that's against this are the sort of 1% employers,
of course,
and also the sort of mid-level restaurant managers and franchise owners and stuff like that that hire these people. But there really wouldn't be a massive hit to corporate profits for these companies if they paid a living wage to their employees. And I also, I mean, there's a degree to which if everyone in your town is working in a fast food restaurant, then, like, there's no market for your product anymore.
Right.
Like, you need to pay people enough so that
they can buy things. Exactly.
Which, any, you know.
Or anything.
Or anything.
I mean, no other business.
Right.
Can
your Home Depot
either.
Is
mean,
not going to exist either if you can't have,
nobody
if no one can buy a home.
Right.
Yeah. Like, I mean, these are all things that end up feeding into themselves. Your business gets better when the people around you start making more
things.
Money.
Well, and the whole economy does better when everybody's buying things.
Yes.
Obviously.
Because the economy is fake, and that's all it takes to make the economy good is people buying stuff.
Yeah.
That's why consumer confidence is really the most important measure of any sort of healthy economy. Because
right.
if people are buying shit, even if they don't have the money, the economy does great for a long time. When it turns out they've spent money they don't have, it falls apart because then they don't have money to buy stuff.
Right.
It's all about people having money to do stuff.
Yeah.
But this made us think a little bit about the history of Labor Day.
Mm-hmm. Which is curious.
It's a curious one. Well, I have spent some time in some communist countries. And in those countries, and most other countries that have labor, because, like, Europe also celebrates Labor Day in May. May Day is Labor Day. It's May 1st.
Yeah.
It sort of was... It coincides with a bunch of, like, old pagan festivals and stuff like that. So it's sort of an exciting day regardless.
Yes.
It's like the beginning of spring. Not at a Labor Day rally.
But why not? It's May Day.
Well, I mean, you could.
You should.
If you're in a small town without labor, I bet you're having maypoles. If you're having a parade because it's May Day, then less so. And it's sort of of late become a holiday that people sort of, like, get angry about globalization and often have anti-U.S. protests on.
Sounds about right.
Which is what happens.
Yeah.
But in any case, May Day, as it turns out, was actually created in the U.S., and it's based on a Chicago labor riot that took place in 1886, where there was sort of a national strike, and there were essentially became a riot in Haymarket Square in Chicago, and on May 4th, there was an anarchist-related bombing.
Yes.
And... But by the way, no one talks about it, but in those days there were anarchists just like everywhere. There was an anarchist attack on the stock market. There are still pockmarks in the stock market like facade.
Really?
From an anarchist attack that took place in the 1800s.
Oh my God.
It's
amazing.
No one talks about the anarchists of those days, but there were a lot of them and they were having a lot of bombing attacks at the time. There were people died, like dozens of people died.
And they were demanding an 8-hour standard workday.
Yeah. Which at the time everyone was like,
yeah, right.
No.
Well, I'm still sort of like that.
Right. Brent's also working on Labor Day, so Brent, he doesn't know. But in any case, those protests eventually did lead to the establishment of the 8-hour workday. These are the same, you know, this labor movement is what brought us the weekend. It's what mm-hmm. brought us the 8-hour workday. It's what brought us, like, overtime laws. Like, it's this sort of early...
child safety laws.
Child safety laws. This incarnation of the labor movement is what brought us all of the things that we think of as just, like, hallmarks of jobs.
Right.
And that's why unions are ultimately important, because unions are what have brought us workplace standards that everyone benefits from. Which is...
Right. Because nobody's just trying to give those to you.
No. No one's trying to give anyone anything.
Right.
No one's trying to give people pensions. But labor unions were.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no one's trying to give you healthcare. But labor unions did. Like,
yep.
It's... These are all things that you need to organize because you, as the employee, don't have any ground to stand on if you
right.
aren't...
By yourself.
By yourself. Because you can always be replaced on an individual level.
Correct.
But you can't replace the entire workforce. That's a pain in the ass. But in any case... May Day is a major holiday in a lot of communist countries.
Interesting.
And so we, in the Cold War era, under Eisenhower, had to stop, put a stop to any, because there have, like, hardcore labor people still celebrate, like, May Day.
Yeah.
We celebrate Labor Day in the U.S., and there's labor.
Should we start celebrating May Day?
Yeah. I celebrate May Day every year.
You do?
Well, I say Happy May Day to my mom.
Okay. Fair enough. But are you saying it out of a... place of knowing that it has to do with labor?
Yeah, I'm saying it out of a place okay. of labor solidarity.
All right, oh, I didn't know.
You got to do that.
Okay, I'm going to start.
Yeah, you got that's
remind
important.
Me this May, please, because I'll forget.
But anyway, in 58, Eisenhower declared May Day Law Day and Loyalty Day as a way of sort of tamping down on the more extreme ends of
sure.
the labor movement
yeah.
that were still mm-hmm. celebrating it.
Yeah.
Because I think probably because the Soviet Union, it was like the biggest holiday they had.
Right.
And... we have, since the 1800s, celebrated Labor Day in the sort of, like, end of summer, September 1st
right.
capacity, which was a way of sort of robbing the labor movement of some of its momentum. Surprisingly, the first Labor Day was celebrated, I think, only on a state level, like in New York or somewhere, like 4 years before that Haymarket Square riot that May Day was named after.
Right.
But it wasn't, it became a national holiday, I think, a bunch of years later. It started in Union Square in 1882 in New York. But we're a special country because we have two Labor Days. One that we don't celebrate.
Right.
And one that we do.
One that we do.
But this Labor Day was sort of an attempt to rob the labor movement of some momentum as sort of a, oh, we care
right.
about you.
Yes.
It's mostly like a shopping holiday now. Like it doesn't, because we don't have any labor.
It also, in LA, is the end to summer Fridays.
Yes.
Usually.
The worst.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what everybody gets really depressed about.
I've been very depressed about that.
Because...
I had summer Fridays.
Right. Now you have to work all
and
day.
I
got to
work all day
Friday.
On Friday, and I don't like that.
Right.
Like that one bit.
So Labor Day really actually sucks for you. The coming of Labor
Day. The coming of Labor Day is
a sign of bad times. Bad
it's
time
also the time that you can't wear white anymore, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
Nobody.
Well, certainly not
that.
In L.A. I mean...
Well, it's a zillion degrees
outside. It's 1 trillion
right
degrees outside.
So
in the entire
hot.
Country. The entire
yeah.
country is 1 trillion degrees.
I know. We were
you
watching
feel free to wear white any day you
we
want.
We were watching the news this morning, and they were talking about how hot it was in New York. And I was like, why aren't they talking about how hot it is here?
I have been, and I almost never turn on my air conditioner. I have been, like, crouching in front of my air conditioner
yeah,
for the entire weekend.
Yeah.
On a holiday weekend, no less.
Yeah.
But in any case, it's, I think, worthwhile to... Think a little bit about labor on May Day, too.
Yeah, let's do it.
Take
or
two of them.
Any day.
Any day is a good day to think about labor.
I agree.
And to appreciate the few days that you get to leave at 6, those are a good time to think
yes.
about the 8-hour workday and
exactly.
appreciate what labor's done for you.
Yes.
Meanwhile,
oh, gosh.
Moving on.
Bob McDonnell,
what
governor
mess.
Of Virginia, who we have talked about before. All of
embroiled
those,
in a bit of a scandal.
Yeah. You know all those gifts that he claimed that he didn't know that he was getting?
He did know.
He actually did. What he meant is that he knew about all of them.
Right. He, by saying that he had not known about any of them, was actually indicating to us that he had known in detail about
specifically
all of them.
About each individual
yes.
one.
Yes. Which, because it sort of defies the laws of English, you may not have caught from his earlier comments. But this week, other people caught that.
Yes.
Because the federal investigators that are investigating this gift situation basically revealed that everything that he's saying is hullabaloo.
Ooh, hullabaloo.
Hullabaloo.
Bringing that back.
I know.
I like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, oh, God.
So now his lawyers are going with a different strategy in which they're just sort of like, they're somehow just like strategically denying this as their plan.
Right.
Like, they're just going to be like, we can't blame him for his ignorance, even though the question is not whether or not he knew. Like,
right.
This is, like, one of those moments where rhetoric goes a really long way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, I mean, it's just crazy because, like, so many of these gifts were, like, I mean, the gifts are sort of
hilarious
anyway, which was sort of, like, why the scandal, I think, is even, like, interesting, because I think to a certain degree, I think there's sort of, like, some assumption that, like, governors or you know, people in power are, so, I mean, I know they're not supposed to get gifts, but,
right,
like,
but we all know they do.
We all know that they do to a certain degree, but, like, these were sort of, like, crazy, and they were, some of them were, like, going to his wife, and there were, like trips to Florida involved, and his kids were, some, I mean, it was just sort of, like, the whole story was, I mean, we've talked about it, so we don't need to go into it necessarily again, but, I mean, like, it was sort of hilarious, which I think had he just gotten normal gifts that governors probably get, I think he would have probably been in the clear. But
well, and I think that there's still a question as to whether he specifically violated the law as it's written. I think that because of the quantity of gifts and the amount that they sort of, like, came to, it came to everyone's attention. But I don't think that they know if he violated the specific law that requires you to disclose gifts over $50 or whatever.
Right.
Because I think a lot of these gifts were sort of, like, non-monetary in value and stuff like that, where he was getting, like, free trips and, like, rides and jets and, like, that sort of stuff.
So I think that we should also just sort of, like, assume that he obviously knew about some of these anyway. It was odd that he sort of, like, denied it, because, like, he's admitted to some of them, because he's already paid the state back for a few of these things that, like, has come to light that he was sort of, like, getting his gifts or, like, giving away to people, you know, using taxpayer money.
His legal strategy at the moment seems to be to both openly admit that he knew and then to deny that he knew and to use the word ignorance.
Right. It's a little haphazard.
They're sort of throwing everything at the wall and seeing what's
ill-conceived.
Exactly.
Potentially. Yeah.
Anyway, there was a story in Politico this week that was fascinating.
Yeah, very.
About Kentucky's approach to the Affordable Care Act.
Right. They're really going for it.
They're into it.
Yeah.
Possibly because they have, like, terrible healthcare issues in that state.
Yeah, probably.
They lead the country in cancer deaths. They lead the country in preventable hospitalizations and smoking. And one of the worst in, like, a whole slew of other categories.
Yeah.
So it's, like, Mississippi-style bad over there.
Right, but that's not...
That's not enough.
I was going to say, but that's not stopping a lot of states,
doing the wrong thing.
I'm doing the wrong thing. So
no, of course
it's
not.
It's interesting that they've gone this route. I mean, I'm glad, but they're starting their exchanges. They're, like, really, I mean, they're doing it.
Here's why. Their governor is term limited. So he's about to leave.
So
he's a Democrat.
Doesn't care.
So he's sort of like,
right, sure.
So he's sort of like, fuck it. And I mean, you know, Mitch McConnell and Rand Paul are their senators. So it's questionable how the state is voting for anyone.
I mean,
who knows what's going on there?
Yeah.
But I think that he was sort of like, you know, he recognizes that there's a need for healthcare in the state. If they're ranked the worst in everything, as a Democrat, it is his prerogative to, like, be invested in these things. I'm surprised that any of the legislature is going along with it. But
they
have to get elected, too. People like having healthcare.
And they may actually be the first state that's going to be declared ready by the federal government.
I know.
Like, they're going to be ready in October.
October 1st. It's amazing. Well, and it's the only state in the South to set up a health insurance. Well, that is possibly why it's going to be ready so early. There's no competition.
Right.
But it's basically, I mean, there's been Republican opposition
of course.
The legislature. There's been stuff like that. But I think that it's one of those states where the need is so great.
They
happen to have a Democratic governor at the right time. He doesn't give a shit because what's he going to do? You know, in 2015, he's out, but he's there long enough. Like, just long enough to set this up, basically.
Well,
and once it's set up, they're not going to want to get rid of it. And he probably saw that coming and was like, you know what?
Right. Well, and there have been sort of, like, you know, random Republican governors who have done this.
I mean, most of the moderate ones.
What's her name?
Jan Brewer.
She was so into it, expanding Medicaid. And even Rick Perry, who's not, I don't think is setting up the exchanges, like, has taken, accepted the money for, like, the Medicaid or Medicare expansion and things like that. So, you know, like, you see these people who are Republicans and who want to, you know, stay away from Obamacare, but they realize that if they want to get elected by the people in their state who are dying and don't have health care, then, you know, perhaps it's a good idea to give them said health care.
Specifically has been happening in a lot of states that have large populations of old people, because it's... Their Medicare costs are pretty high over there.
Like, everybody who lives in Arizona is retired.
1,000 years old. You move there once you're retired.
Correct.
That's the only reason that you would go there.
Yeah.
So for them to not have set, you know, for them to not have set up any of the sort of benefits that you get from Obamacare is just like sort of insane.
Stupid. Yeah.
And the same, you know, I think New Mexico did the same. Like a lot of those states that are sort of like the warm weather states that you go to in the winter when you're from a cold place, those states really had no choice. Like, what were they going to do? Just continue to tax everyone through the nose for healthcare programs that they could have been getting for free from the federal government? Like, that's a crazy thing to do.
Yeah.
But in any case, I think, I hope, that this... I think that if he's... If Beshear, the governor of Kentucky, is in office until 2015, it will be just enough time to sort of establish that the Affordable Care Act is great news for everyone. And I think probably it will start to influence what some of the other states in the region
do. That's what I was just about to say. If it can work in Kentucky and you live in one of the bordering states of Kentucky,
like, you're not
and you realize
be like, wait a minute,
how great all of your friends in Kentucky are now, you know, not dying of whatever it was they were dying from.
Preventable illness.
They have, you know, free healthcare. Well, not free healthcare, but
they're
have
paying
they
an
have
affordable
access,
price for healthcare.
Have access to healthcare. Then, you know, you might want your elected officials
to consider
get in on
such
that.
Well, and
might sound like a great plan.
I think that if it goes along in Kentucky enough that the Republicans there start to have to sort of tacitly support it, maybe we can start to remember that this is a Republican idea to begin with, and that Republicans
That's
could all benefit from support. There's nothing inherently un-Republican about this.
Well, no. It's inherently Republican.
Because
they invented it.
There's nothing inherently Democratic about it.
Correct.
Is what the issue is.
Right.
But, I mean, it should work great for the South.
You would think.
You would think.
Yeah.
All that free money from the federal... They love free money from the federal government.
Well,
what are they even thinking?
I was going to say.
People in the South would like you to think otherwise. But
anywhere.
We're paying their way.
Yes, correct.
They want nothing more than free money from the federal government.
Yeah.
That's how they're supporting everything that they hasn't fallen apart already in, like, Mississippi is being paid for by California and New York and Texas.
Yeah, but they hate those places.
They
though.
Hate those places.
They hate the federal government.
They hate the federal
and
government.
They hate taxes.
But they love free money.
Yep.
As do we all. But we're not getting any of it.
No.
Oh, gosh. Also, though, because I think the deadline is starting to approach for these exchanges to be set up, and the Secretary of Explaining Stuff is back. Mm-hmm. Bill Clinton's being sent on the road to explain Obamacare. He did a great job of it during that speech. Was it at the Democratic convention or whatever, where he sort of laid out the case for it? I think. Probably everyone has sort of forgotten about his brilliant turn there.
Yeah.
And so he's being sent on the road again to sort of shore up some support and explain stuff to people.
Yes, which he is able to do. And he's usually
That is what he's good at.
He's usually able to do it better than anyone else, better than the president. I mean, a lot of times, a lot of people said that Bill Clinton was sort of like able to lay out the issues and vision of, you know, Obama's second term better than Obama had sort of ever been able to do leading up to that point.
Exactly.
So maybe this will work. Maybe maybe everybody will realize what a great idea Obamacare is all of a sudden.
I think that this might be what Bill Clinton's actual strength was as a president, as a human. I don't think that he's a great negotiator. I actually question his negotiation. He loves to compromise.
I was going
to
say.
He's a big compromiser. But I don't think he's a good negotiator. You know, I think that there are other... I think... Dick Cheney might be a great negotiator.
Probably.
You know, like, I think that there are other
good
people...
Good negotiators get what they want.
Exactly. Bill Clinton maybe got what he wanted, but he certainly didn't get what his party wanted ever. You know, he was, like, giving away stuff to the right, left, right, and center. But he's a great explainer. So he's good at communicating what the benefits of whatever thing that he didn't give away are.
He can sell you anything.
He can sell you anything. And I think that probably that he should have been, like, a national salesman for the Democratic Party. They shouldn't even... Like, President... is nonsense. Al Gore could have been running the country and doing as effective a job.
Yeah.
And we'd probably have some better environmental legislation if he did.
Sure.
But Bill Clinton is just sort of like the guy that you want to explain the complicated position that the Democrats always have that's, you know, because the Republicans get away with it because they simplify things to a degree that's laughable.
Right,
and then
exactly.
You're sort of like, yes. I do.
Black
I do hate everything, things that are bad.
Yes, everything is black and white for them.
Yes.
Obama should... slip Bill Clinton the Syria talking points and
I know.
Just see if he can sort of mix the, put those in the mix and see what he can do while he's out there.
I feel like this is maybe something...
I know this isn't what I hired you to do right now, but I've got a little bit of a problem on my hands
But why
here.
Don't
this
you take a look at these?
Situation.
I think
see
that
what
this
do.
Is what he should have been doing all along with everything. Is like sending Bill Clinton to explain it.
Yeah. Well, I think
what Hillary should be planning her campaign around.
I think for most of the first term, he probably couldn't send Bill Clinton around to do these things. I think that
though that
that wasn't an option.
Yeah, correct. For sure. It's an option now. It's an option now. And I think that it's more important now. Because in his first term, as he was facing a lot of opposition, but he was getting stuff done. Because he was not facing the kind of opposition from Congress that he's facing.
And it's a good idea for Bill to do, because he's basically running for president on Hillary's behalf here by sort of explaining Obamacare.
Exactly. I mean, it's perfect. It's a good strategy for him. Yeah. I was going to say, Hillary should be considering this a win, because Hillary is basically getting free campaign time out of this all.
Well, and she's a healthcare guru. I mean, she could be doing this herself, too, to a certain degree. Or she claims to be. I mean,
makes me real skeptical.
Maybe don't send her out to do this.
Hillary Clinton was the person who ran on not having the mandate. She was not pro-mandate until she absolutely had to be.
That's true.
And Bill Clinton is currently being sent out to explain the mandate to everyone, which everyone knew was absolutely necessary to make this policy work.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton should be nowhere near a microphone right now. Yeah. In fact, if she was nowhere near a place right now, that would even help.
Yeah.
She can just let Bill run her campaign for the moment. She's probably writing a book, so she can probably just sit at home and write that book. Stay away from this debate, Hillary, because this is not going
to
win you the presidency.
She should just hope that everything is in place by the time that she has to run for president, so she doesn't have... Her husband will have already explained it, so she doesn't have to.
Like, if I were her, I would step real far away from healthcare, because I think that her positions on it are going to come back to bite her in the ass when she runs again.
Yeah.
You know? She won't do it, but she should.
Yeah.
That's from me to you, Hillary. From your close friend, Lila.
Yes.
In other news...
Oh, God.
Our level of rightness is astounding, as usual.
It's astounding. And sometimes it comes when you least expect it, too. Because I wasn't really expecting to be hearing this week, but Congress is coming back.
Right. September 9th, they start.
Right. So, there has been a lot of talk, sort of like, what their agenda is going to be when they come back. And obviously, when they left, the Senate had just passed an immigration bill, and the House was sort of, like, debating whether they were going to do it piecemeal, or what parts they agreed on, and blah, 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 and
that was sort of one of their big issues.
That was, like, what they were going to get done. And even when they left, they were like, we're going to come back, and we're going to deal with immigration reform. So what happens? They go back to their districts, and they have all of their, you know, racist people at their town halls talk about how much they hate brown people.
Right.
And then also this whole Syria
situation
happens. They also remember that they're going to have to shut down the government over Obamacare and the debt ceiling.
They are busy people.
And they're busy people. And all of a sudden everybody realizes, you know, all of the pundits are sort of like, oh, wait, there is no way in hell that they are going to get to immigration reform in the next decade.
And they have... They only have 3 months to shut down the entire federal government.
Right. They have too much work to do without passing a comprehensive immigration bill.
Yeah.
And we said that...
Months ago.
Months ago. Before they even... Before the Senate passed anything, before anybody started debating the merits of an immigration bill,
we knew
that this was never, ever, ever going to get done. We couldn't foresee the circumstances.
Right. You never can. I would argue, though, that this was their secret plan all along. Because they were at an impasse when they left for their summer vacations.
Right.
They, I think, knew that whatever way they decided to go on this issue, they were going to get in trouble. Any active involvement in the issue gets them in trouble. Passing a bill gets them in trouble. Mm-hmm. Not passing a bill gets them in trouble. Just talking about immigration reforms getting them in trouble. They knew that. Now, they're not considering the long-term consequences of this, because in the long term, this gets them into much bigger trouble.
Right.
Because... In the long term, Arizona is going to be blue. Texas is going to start going blue. Like, random states like North Carolina that have big immigrant populations are going to start going blue. Like, they're never, ever going to see the presidency again.
Yeah.
But in the short term, it seems like a brilliant...
They'll get elected again.
They'll get elected again. That's all they care about. The long game is not their strong suit these days.
No.
But I think that they were looking for sort of like a way to let this fade out into the distance.
Yeah.
Because I think that this is the last thing in the short term that they wanted to have to deal with.
No.
And... When they can get to real crowd pleasers, like shutting down the entire government and getting rid of Obamacare, they don't have time for something as nuanced as immigration reform.
No.
You know? I mean, if the immigration reform bill says something more complicated than let's build a giant wall, their districts aren't going to want to know.
They're out. Yeah.
So that's why me and Brent knew. Because it was pretty easy to foresee that no one wanted to actually do anything about
this. We didn't
need
to know the details.
No.
We just needed to know some sort of
Syria or no Syria.
We just needed to know some top-line information about what's going on in the districts and the brains of the House Republicans.
Exactly.
And that was all that we needed.
That was all that was necessary.
But beyond that, now they've got all this. Now they have excuses.
Yeah.
Like,
Well, they were just running out the clock so that they could find some excuses. Because we always knew they were going to have the excuse of having to shut down the whole government and having to get rid of Obamacare.
Well, if you can...
If you think they repealed Obamacare a lot of times before this last 3 months...
Well, there's a
debt... I would guarantee that they're going to, like, double their number.
Right. Well, there's a debt ceiling re-up every year.
Right.
So, if you can just sort of push off...
Anything until the debt ceiling.
If you can just putz around for a year, which they're good at...
Yeah, they've been doing that all year.
Then you can just always get to the next debt ceiling debate, which has to...
Which can last for months.
As we know.
As we know.
Yeah.
And can prevent any future discussions from taking place on any issue.
Right. Because everybody ends up hating each other.
Yeah. And also because it's a totally, like, unsubstantive debate. Like, there's no actual topic in that debate. Like, there's no information to discuss.
No.
It's just, like, vague threats, mostly. But immigration reform... is dead.
Bye.
Bye.
Sucks.
But it sucks. It also...
It makes us happy because we were right, but it makes us sad that they're not going to do anything.
I think that whatever would have actually come out of this policy would have been one of those policies that sounds like a good idea until you secretly realize that it's made things harder for immigrants. I felt was actually going to be damaging, probably. Like, I haven't read the bill. I don't know. But the fact that such a bunch of know-nothing numbnutses were involved in writing it made me suspect that this was a cover for making things harder.
Yeah, well, they weren't going to get it right.
No.
They were just going to do something.
They were going to do something that was nothing. So I sort of feel like at least this leaves the need open.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we can have the president decide to stop deporting... dreamers and things like that. Like, these are things that we can do without Congress that we are doing. The things that were sort of like the things that were actually going to make things better for immigrants are things that the president can stop doing. The things that were going to make the red tape more complicated
are what
Congress was talking about.
You know what he can stop doing? Deporting a record number of people.
Exactly. He could,
he could continues to let set
his
record for...
lie and just go back to the old system in which he just sort of like... didn't do much. Or he never did that. He's like a real deporter. He loves a good deportation.
Yeah.
Warms his heart. Splitting up families just makes him thrilled. But in any case, moving on. As usual, we have plenty of gay news here. If you were worried that we weren't going to get to that because it was Labor Day, you were wrong.
Oh, God. Liz Cheney.
Chief among it is that...
Who's running for the Senate in Wyoming.
Right.
And has... A lesbian sister.
Yeah.
Doesn't think the gays should really be getting married much.
No. Certainly not.
What a
not
bitch.
People like her sister.
God. Even her father.
I know.
Is pro-gay marriage.
I know.
Dick Cheney.
Well, and
one
I
of the evilest people on earth thinks the gays should get married.
Has met a gay person, realized that his daughter getting married would not be the end of the world.
Right.
And moved on with his life.
Yep.
All it takes is meeting a gay person, usually. You know,
but he's even put in some calls to some people. I mean, like, not only has he not just, like, gone on with his life, he's actually been, like, a decent advocate.
Yeah. Well, I think he probably, because he's an evil mastermind, knows that this is a losing proposition for the Republicans anyway.
Probably.
You know, he's not the religious right.
He's horrible. But
he's horrible and evil, but he's not the religious right.
He's not.
He's evil in the most straight-ahead kind of way that a person can be evil. He literally has evil thoughts. He doesn't have stupid thoughts. He's not misled by a church.
No.
He is having evil thoughts full-time. And I think that because
that's how his brain is wired.
Exactly. Yeah. I think because of that, he can see beyond the religious right appeal of this issue to the fact that it's total losing proposition.
Yeah, he's an evil mastermind.
He's an evil mastermind.
Yeah.
This is the kind of issue that a mastermind would know is not worth the time of the Republican Party.
Right.
But apparently Liz Cheney, less of a mastermind.
Didn't get those genes.
Didn't get those genes.
No.
And so I think what happened was, she's running against Mike Enzo. The race has sort of pitted her, or has... defined her as sort of like this pro-gay marriage, pro-abortion person as a way, because they know that she has gay family and they're sort of trying to mislead the public into voting for Mike Enzo.
So she's had to sort of like come out and...
So she's had to really have a strong, because she also came out.
She didn't come out. No.
But she had to have a really strong response in which she was like, I'm pro-life and I hate gay marriage and gross. Because she's basically... getting defined as the opposite by the opposition, even though it's a total lie.
Right.
Because she's obviously just as hateful and terrible as the rest of them.
Obviously.
I mean, let's not kid ourselves.
I mean, you're not winning a Republican primary in Wyoming by not being
wonderful. No. She, I think, had in the past spoken out against Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Yeah, all right.
Which is more of a user-friendly issue than marriage.
Yes.
I mean, everyone was against that, mostly because Clinton had put it in place, and so everyone could be against it.
It was a safe one. Yeah, safe.
Literally every person in America had a reason to be against that policy. Uh-huh. But in any case, her sister had to release a statement being like, I love my sister, but she's being wrong, and, you know, because...
Oh, God.
It's disaster. But, in good news for gays, Ruth Bader Ginsburg...
Did a gay wedding.
Yeah.
She officiated a gay wedding.
Yeah.
Bless her heart.
It was the president of the Kennedy Center and his partner, who's an economist, John Roberts.
John Roberts.
Exactly. Can you...
Not Chief Justice,
John Roberts. Can you imagine what that marriage is going to be like?
Well, boring.
The most boring marriage in history.
For one.
One of the least exciting groups of people. Like, that is a dinner party you want.
I bet it was a nice wedding, though.
Probably. Well, it was probably lovely. The Supreme Court justice officiated.
Right.
So, you don't just invite them to some dumpster City Hall wedding.
No.
You cater that shit.
Yeah, you do. Uh-huh.
So, it's probably a lovely event.
Yes.
But yeah, that's the first Chief Justice gay marriage wedding ceremony.
So good on
situation. So that's good work. And finally, only months after we legalized this,
I know. I was surprised that this was a news story, and I almost didn't even put it on here because I was like,
but it was in every major news source.
In every major news source, because I was just sort of like, well, this seems like a sort of duh moment, obvious, but everybody was talking about it this week because maybe there was no.
It was
other
an
news
announcement,
other than
I think,
Syria,
too.
But it was an announcement. Jack Lew, I think,
finally
did the announcement or whatever. But
gays can file taxes jointly for their federal taxes,
right? And I think what was sort of the news story potentially about this is that you can file jointly wherever you live if you were married someplace else.
Yes. And that is a big deal.
That is a big deal.
Because then I think you can just go get married in Massachusetts or wherever and move to whatever dumb state you live in.
And
get the tax benefits.
A lot of times the tax benefits are paying more taxes.
Right.
So
don't really do it if that's the case.
I don't know if that's a tax benefit or not.
But you can file separately or together when you're married. And now you can do that if you're gay. So.
Yeah.
Good work, everyone. But that was, I think, a sort of exciting concept. It's necessary in order to ensure that gay couples are being treated fairly by the federal government, regardless of where they live, which is
what the federal government is. If you can't get a gay... Not enforcing DOMA, then you have to be able to file as a married couple, even if you're living in a state that doesn't recognize gay marriage, if you were gay married.
Because if we're recognizing gay marriages at the federal level, it doesn't matter what state you live in.
Right.
Your state can do whatever they want. That's their evil business. But... taxes. But and New Jersey signed an equal pay bill.
I know.
The very same that the Congress of the United States cannot pass.
Nope.
Because they're evil. Yeah. But Chris Christie, apparently, less evil than Congress. Good to know.
Wow.
Something to think about.
Well, the thing
about Chris Christie, sweetheart wielding.
Right. Yes.
He's a real condescending asshole who's not very nice to women.
Correct. Well, the thing about Chris Christie and that sort of like people forget a lot, I think, is that he is the governor of New Jersey, and he has a Democratic
legislature,
like big time.
Yeah.
So things like this end up on his desk.
Yeah.
And he can't be the guy that doesn't pass them. He can't not sign that. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it may not necessarily go over in a primary, but he also has to get reelected to a certain degree.
Yeah.
And it's not happening in New Jersey if he's not signing the equal pay law. So good on Chris Christie. I think that if Chris Christie was the governor of Texas, he probably would have not signed that.
Correct.
But also probably would have not ended up on his desk, for that matter.
He also would not have been the governor.
He wouldn't, right,
there are so many. There are so many obstacles.
A lot of ifs.
Yeah.
But
this is a law like the Paycheck Fairness Act that is currently languishing in Congress that allows you to sort of research what other people in your your job description are making and stuff like that, so that women aren't routinely paid 77 cents on the dollar to men, which is what happens. And so that's good news for the women of New Jersey.
Yeah. And
the sweethearts of New Jersey. God.
He's terrible. Yeah.
And in final news.
Oh God, this is hilarious.
It was Herbert Walker. It was.
Oh yes. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
yes.
It was Elder Bush.
Yes.
Bobby Bush.
41.
Who, to be 41. Fair, is not running his own office at this point because he's senile.
He's really old.
Sick.
Bless his heart.
He's very old. Mm-hmm. He's likes to sort of be... They wheel him out for various functions, but he's not really up to much.
No.
His office, however, is up to too much. Because one of his spokespersons, Jim McGrath, misread a news alert on Sunday that was describing Nelson Mandela's health. And, you know, Nelson Mandela has been in poor health for a while.
A while. He's been
They sort of thought that he was maybe not going to make it a few months ago. He did make it out of the hospital
time. But then he's back. One day when we were doing the podcast, we were like, when you listen to this, Nelson Mandela may have died. So if that happened,
But then it didn't happen.
That was months ago.
Yeah. But in any case, Jim McGrath maybe jumped the gun a little bit.
He did.
And, you know, these places all have sort of, like, pre-written obituaries.
Yeah, I mean,
I
have friends who, like, work at newspapers and magazines and sort of, like,
you write the obituaries for the people that are important and might die.
You sort of, like, joke about who you have obituaries for, because sometimes they're people who you wouldn't even think that you have obituaries for. You have, like, you know, even people, you know, Lindsay Lohan probably has an obituary written for her, even though she's young, but she's been on drug vendors. And, you know, you literally anybody who might die, you have obituaries lying around for, because if they die, then you don't want to have to take
an hour
to...
You gotta run that shit.
Yeah, you gotta be out with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, they had the one for Nelson Mandela and just...
Pushed go.
You know, pushed go. Little early.
And so, apparently... USA Today published the statement. I think after we knew that it was...
Well, right.
I mean, USA Today didn't publish a statement thinking that Nelson Mandela said...
news story.
Right.
Yeah.
Barbara and I mourn the passing of one of the greatest believers in freedom we had the privilege to know.
Yes.
Yeah. So, and then goes on to talk about how wonderful Nelson Mandela was.
Sad.
It's sad when two old people are accidentally releasing obituaries for each other.
I know. Well, And like, did Mandela
respond? Is Nelson Mandela
respond
his office
one for
also
George Herbert Walker? I feel like they should have.
It's the war of the open. This could have easily happened to Nelson. I bet they have a George Bush, you know, document lying around.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because everyone's got to have a statement.
Yeah.
It was a lovely sentiment.
It was. It was
a little
very,
bit premature.
Very kind words from George Bush. Oh, man.
Yes. In any case... That's the news.
That's the news. Happy Labor Day.
Happy Labor Day.
We're going to leave you with one of our other favorites.
Yeah. We have some good labor music for you.
Yeah.
This one a little bit more modern. But we will...
We'll talk
to you next week. Bye.
Bye. Never knock. Every job they offer used to kick you out the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knock. I hate the army and I hate the RAF. I don't wanna go fighting in the Gulag. I hate the 7 star this boom. I won't open that phone for you. Career opportunity, the one that never knock. Every job they offer used to keep you at the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Oi, 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 oi. Bus driver, Andy the Grand. The tickets it breaks the down. All the time. Bang on a hat to introduce conscription. Bang on a hat to take away my prescription. Never knock. Every job they offer used to kick you out the door. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked.